So I guess the first question that we're going to ask is if you think that you were targeted by, was it by the school originally who decided that the investigation needed to happen? Some administrator at your school, the high school?
Oh, that's kind of murky. That's never been made clear to me. I believe that some reactionary elements in the community who turned out to counter-demonstrate against our anti-war protest December 9th, they complained to the school board, and that's when the investigation started, because before that point, before December 9th, before our first protest, I had not gotten any complaints directly from students, parents, anybody.
Were you on television? Is that part of it? Because of an increased level of public exposure?
I was on TV, I think, for the second protest in January.
These are bi-weekly, these demonstrations that you're having, and they're kind of...
We're holding them the second Sunday of the month.
So you're continuing to do that?
Yes, which has also made the Naples Daily News, which is leading the charge against me, and the school district really indignant that I've had the audacity to continue to help to organize and participate in the anti-war protest, even though, to use their language, even though I'm still under investigation.
Speaking of which, when you were initially put under investigation back in January, I believe, you had all your classes taken.
December, second week of December, right after the first protest.
When did you have your mass media classes pulled from you?
Before the investigator had even finished asking me 6 hours worth of questions, right before Christmas break, so halfway through December, about a week or so after the first protest, my principal, so that would be my direct supervisor, he told me it would be, quote, best for everyone concerned if I didn't teach mass media after Christmas break.
And you were saying you filed a grievance...
The union, yes.
...with your union about that. What's the position of your union? I'm guessing they've been supportive. It mentioned in one of the articles, one of them was at your hearing yesterday.
Yes, my union president was at the hearing with me. He thinks it's an important case. He said that if he were in my position, he'd do exactly the same thing. I get the sense, at least to this point, that they're behind me 100%.
Do you think that that will help you to actually get your classes back, or?
Yes, I mean, the process is long. It's from what I can figure out at this point. The school district will fight it every step of the way. It'll have to go to arbitration, and then some supposedly objective third-party arbitrator will come in and decide. I think, and my union president thinks that in the long run, I'll win. It'll just take a long time. I'll get my classes back. That's what we're hoping.
You mentioned a few seconds ago when I was talking to you off the air that the majority of the questions he asked you, despite the fact that it says in the report has nothing to do with any political activities that you might engage in outside of the school. Despite that fact, apparently the majority of the questions that you were posed by the investigator had to do with your political activities outside of the school. That's correct?
Sure. My political activity over the past 5 or 6 years, wanted me to elaborate on all of that, and so I did, and he wanted to know my perspective on the history of Afghanistan. He wanted to know why I would show a documentary like Showdown in Seattle to my classes. He wanted to know why I would show a film. I mean, this is in the classroom, of course, but all coming back to a political perspective, my political perspective, that was the thing that was always being called into question, and whether the questions had something to do with my direct participation in some sort of protest or some sort of direct action or anything of that nature, over to showing film like Showdown in Seattle, where other participants, independent media types walking around with camcorders, their experience as well. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make that the focus, I felt, of the whole thing, not so much the classroom and the whole charge, the most damning charge, the one that they're attempting to prove, is that I only present views from my political perspective and exclude all others, which is not the case.
So their allegation that you do not, how did they put it, so-called alternative materials, meaning, I guess, materials from mainstream media in this
context.
So that's
alternative. Alternative to the to the investigator means CNN or Fox or
and he says that
the New York Times. And even though I spent a lot of time on tape, and that's the crazily ironic thing about the report, is that this is all on tape and then redacted onto paper as well, and so you can just compare what he writes in his report with the transcription and with the tape, which I'm in the process of doing now. Anyway, I explained to him on tape that, and I gave him all copies of all the texts that we used in class,
right.
And every article that I ever used in class, because I was taught this way by great teachers myself, they all use the good old method of counter-argument. Edward S. Herman, Noam Chomsky, John Pilger, Robert McChesney, they all started off, fair inaccuracy in reporting, they all started off with, the New York Times today reported that such and such and such, or Bill O'Reilly's Fox today said we should turn Afghanistan into a parking lot, da 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 da, da. And then they would insert their spin, and then they would insert their statistics, usually drawn from the Pentagon's own information, and to flesh out the argument so that it wasn't CNN's version of the news, which is half the news all the time, even raising the fact that maybe CNN or whoever it was, source happened to be is not presenting the whole story. That's the audacious thing that they find. And so instead of saying that, they say that my view is the only view. No one was allowed to argue with my view.
Right.
If someone would say, what about what CNN said today? That I would say, well, we can't talk about that sort of thing, even though I was presenting to them what CNN was saying and then responding to it as well.
Right. To make the allegation to make the insinuation, at least, that students wouldn't have enough exposure to CNN just in their daily lives
is crazy.
Kind of ridiculous.
I mean, you go into our school building, or into any school building in the county, and your eyes are besieged by posters with F-15s glorifying the military. You walk into our library, you go through the turnstiles, and the very first thing you see are two huge literature racks about 7 feet high with pamphlets by, I don't remember which branches of the military, maybe the Army, USMC. I mean, there's no rack for the War Resisters League or Veterans for Peace or anybody like that. I mean, there are recruiters in the hallways at lunchtime on a daily basis. There's the whole JROTC program. I don't know if you have a similar thing in Canada or not.
We don't.
But I mean, militarism is just rampant in the schools. And I mean, when this whole thing started, just out of curiosity, I asked my students, who sort of took a little informal poll of my mass media students before they took them away from me, I asked them just to think about how much awake time during the day and during the week they had, and how much of it was taken up by voices from people like me, and how much was taken up with another perspective. And
right.
they laughed because it was a tiny voice.
Have you found the students to be generally supportive of your predicament?
Well, I can tell you what the investigator found, and it seems this is one thing.
Well, he mentions very few. Apparently, it says he only interviewed 14 of the students in the report.
He told me on tape between 10 and 12, and I said, "You mean 11?" But anyway, so he wrote 15, whatever. There's nothing to quibble about. But he did say, my union president and I chuckled at the time on tape when he said this, that it seemed to him that they broke into kind of three camps, the students that he interviewed. Again, this is not much of a chunk, 15 out of about 75. 80 students, maybe more. Anyway, they broke into three camps. And this is his spin, of course. There were those who were fiercely loyal to me. Sort of, you know, robotically loyal, I got the sense, according to him. There were those who were hostile to a lot of what I was trying to get them to think about. And there were those who just didn't really seem to have a clue what was going on in class.
Now, right.
Union president and I chuckled because that could, you know, that could describe a lot of classes and a lot of schools. Anyway, he said, but, and this is on the tape, but of course not in the report, he said, but Mr. Harvey, even the ones who were hostile toward you, not one of them would say that you were unfair in any way. Now, implied in that, I mean, I'm a student of language, is that he tried to get them, one of them, to say that I was unfair. Not
right.
One of them would make a statement that you were unfair in any way. He said that to me on tape, but you've read parts of the report.
Right.
It seems to be completely tilted the other way now.
Yeah.
That many of them felt that was unfair. Many of them felt as if they didn't have the right to say war is the answer or to complain about my perspective in any way. I found myself usually trying to stir things up, play devil's advocate, taking the side of individual soldiers in the heat of battle, just trying to stir a discussion up in any kind of way, and I was usually met with a lot of passivity, and my experience has been that unfortunately a lot of my students are passive to the dominant ideology, and then when they're presented with another view, I a lot of times expect them to just be incredulous and want to argue with me and say, that's just not so. But it seems a lot of times that they are accepting of negative things said about their own government's actions as if, oh man, I can believe anything that they would do. I get that a lot from students.
Well, cynicism.
Yeah, it's a, and they don't believe that they have any power to do anything to change that. They just, I get this sense that they feel demoralized. The more that they hear, they just go, oh man, one more rotten thing that this guy's telling me. And so, I can understand why somebody would not want to hear that. But when I try to infuse them also with some sense that there is something that we can do, first of all, just by knowing about it and talking about it and seeking out alternative media and telling our friends and actually just beginning a conversation that we're not having on a local, a national level. We're just not having the conversation at all. These things are just not on the table for discussion. That's a starting point, that they can write letters to the editor like I do. That's like the only democratic forum we have in our town. I was always encouraging them to do that. However they feel about the war, to write letters to the editor, to engage in dialogue with others. That's how we start the process of, you know, building our democracy. That's always been my focus.
There's so many weird, there's so many things that are difficult to believe in the guy's report.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking as well of the young lady who asked you to tone things down or maybe not teach
it. The word invective. That's not my students' language. No student, that never happened. It never happened. The other thing is, when we started out with the taping process, the investigator asked me if I wanted to know the identity of the students. I mean, if it were court, I would just assume that, sure, yes. But when I thought about it and had a little conference in private with my union president, I decided I didn't want to know because
okay.
I don't want to be accused later on of somehow
some
trying
kind
to get
of bias.
Revenge against, you know, academically or something.
That's one of the other allegations that they make, though, or one of the insinuations that the investigator makes, at the very least, is that after September 11th, something like 60% of your students ended up with D's.
Oh, that is something that, first of all, I haven't gone back and checked to see what the actual number is, but I tell you something that really shocked me that happened. When my classes were taken away from me in the middle of December, it was right around the end of the marking period, the end of the semester, and they all had a journal due, which is worth 20% of the grade. Now, I've been teaching high school students this is my 11th year, and to be honest, most people fail because they just don't turn things in. And they just got too many things on their plate, they just, they get behind, et cetera, et cetera. But never have I had a group of classes, three classes in this case, where so many people just didn't turn this journal in, just didn't turn it in. And this is a theory I have, and it's something I haven't had the chance to go around and interview people, because my students were just taken away from me. They came back after Christmas. Some of them didn't even take the midterm. They didn't turn in their journals, and I really have a strong...
Oh, you think that they, had that happened, that their marks would have significantly been higher?
And I also get the sense that they got the impression that this guy's on his way out. Normally what would happen is people grub for grades.
Right.
I mean, I did it. I probably would still do it if I were taking a graduate course or something. And only a couple of students came to me, students that were just grubbing the difference between an A and a B, or a B and a C. But these students that he says are 67%, I don't know if that's true, but the DNF students, some of them, in fact, many of them had an opportunity to do something about that. Normally would go to any teacher, myself included, because I did at the end of the marking period before that, around September 11th, when that wasn't even an issue. Not so many people didn't turn in their journals then. I really had the sense that they figured, you know, this guy's in the paper every day, he's being vilified. And then they came back to school, and the class, my class was just gone, and quite a few complained to me, complained to others about the fact that they were being taken out of my class and given to two other teachers. And I get the sense that the implication they got some kind of way might have been, again, I haven't interviewed them, all right. of them, that it didn't matter. That mm-hmm. it didn't matter about this journal. And the journal, which he doesn't mention at all in his report, though he did take a copy of one of the journals that I had, because he asked for it, he made copies. I asked him to do a thing I call propaganda hunting, where I asked them to just keep their eyes and ears open wherever they go. It's easy to do in my classroom, because my classroom's got political posters all over the walls. It's easy to see what my messages are.
He mentions that in the report. He criticized you for having anti-war posters and no pro-war posters.
I know, I do step outside the door to see plenty of pro-war posters. But I asked my students to go to all public space or any space private if they liked that they felt comfortable writing about and note what they felt were the messages that were coming at them, to get into conversations with their other teachers and ask them, what do posters in your room mean? And to write all this stuff down. I also asked them to listen to mainstream news, watch mainstream news like CNN, or even just when they open up their AOL account, there's a little news thing there as soon as you open up AOL or Netscape Navigator or something like that to give you the blurb there, a little poll thing about the president, whatever. I told them, here's a list of about 35 terms like national interest, terrorism, evil, which the president was using a lot at the time. It's about 35 terms. I said, I want you to listen for these terms and try to figure out how the newscasters are using them and what they mean by them. Thinking that if they just did that, that would force them to listen to mainstream, quote unquote, corporate media and try to figure out what all these euphemisms, because that's what they are, what all these euphemisms mean. I call it corporate media speak. History textbooks use the same kind of language. I told them they could use history textbooks as well. All mainstream things. Hoping that some students would not only do that, but some students, and the best students did this as well, they wrote down what they interpreted as the definition that the media implied by using a particular term, mm-hmm. like national interest. And then they also said, but I believe what it really means is such and such and such. And some of them did that, and some of them just wrote down what they assumed the word meant, because that's what corporate media doesn't do. They don't explain their terms. The assumption is that we all know what they mean. Okay. And so I just asked them to hunt for those. It was a pretty simple exercise if you watch the news, but I know from talking to my students they didn't watch the news at all, not alternative media or corporate media, so I was asking them to spend some time doing that. I assume that some of them just didn't want to do that, didn't have the time, they had other coursework they had to worry about, and that others might have gotten the message that it didn't matter because I was on my way out. Again, I'd have to interview all of them to get a poll on that. But it was basically propaganda hunting and checking out these euphemisms that the corporate media uses. And I told them if they really wanted to ask themselves if they understood what corporate media meant by a term like national interest, they could always go to the alternative websites we use, like Alternet, ZMag, IndieMedia.org, because the commentators there definitely talk about what those euphemisms mean and try to explain them to their audiences. They could take that or leave that. I just left out an option. Just go to CNN, go to ABC, whatever, Fox, and or go to alternative media as well. And that was always an option. I showed them Showdown in Seattle. The investigator points that out, that I used Showdown in Seattle. But what he doesn't point out is that for extra credit, not just for class credit, for extra credit, I asked them to go to the Internet and go back to November 1999, when the protests against the WTO were taking place in Seattle, and read mainstream corporate media news accounts of how the protesters were portrayed, how the police were portrayed, for example, in CNN, and compare that with how Whisper Media, Indie Media, Paper Tiger TV, all the people who collaborated in the production of Showdown in Seattle. And I told them up front, this is an unapologetically pro-protester piece of film. They call the middle section police riot. They show the police pulling goggles off protesters' faces. They're just sitting there mm-hmm. passively blocking an intersection and pepper spraying them over and over and over again. and beating them with their sticks. I said, go to CNN and see how CNN portrays the protesters and portrays the police. And quite a few of them did. Brought in reports about how CNN portrayed the same 5 days that shook the WTO. So, reporter doesn't mention that. He mentions a Mumia video, which was shown once on HBO. Even the title of the video, he cuts it in half. The title of the video is Mumia Abu-Jamal, A Case for Reasonable Doubt? Question mark. The thing opens and closes with intermingled cries of cop killer and free Mumia. The thing is so balanced. It is incredibly balanced. Of course, you know, the Fraternal Order Police, the FBI, and others, you know, they trashed it and said it was completely biased, but any objective observer, I think, would think otherwise.
I'm guessing that the allegations that the investigator made about the, there was something about an anonymous email and you threatened the student with dismissal from the class.
No, he has some, I don't know if you saw, but he has a couple of pages of email conversation. A lot of it's between one particular student calling himself pro-national socialism without identifying himself in any kind of way. My students didn't know if he was even one of them or if he was a former student, if he was somebody from the community, because I'd had death threats and and people were contacting me anonymously and telling me all these kinds of sort of violent things they were going to do to me. And a lot of the students I talked to thought that, I mean, they just didn't know who this guy was, and this went on for weeks. And he would send them posts about my propaganda, how one-sided it was, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then he didn't even include me on the list, and so he was talking about things that I supposedly believed in, like I believed in the dictatorship, and like he did, and we agreed on that point, supposedly, that sort of thing. And then people in the group, they would forward things that he had posted to me because I hadn't seen them. And so I tried a long process of being up late at night on weekends trying to get this guy to do a couple of things. I mean, I told him he didn't have to identify himself to me. All he had to do was anonymously just do what everybody else had to do on a daily basis. You just had to say something, anything, about anything remotely relevant to anything we were talking about on a particular day to get 100% class participation credit.
Right.
I mean, people just say something monosyllabic and get the same amount of credit as someone who wanted to talk the whole time, because that's the only way I could see it as being a democratic thing. Participation just means to speak and to get your feet wet and to try to talk and engage in the discussion. Okay? And I said to him, you know, this is all anonymous. I didn't know who he was for the longest time. That, you know, why not just, you don't have to admit that you've been doing all this attacking and mocking the other students who agree with me in any kind of way, saying that they're all a bunch of patsies and sheep for even considering Mr. Harvey's point of view, etc. Again, with hiding the whole time in his own anonymity while others didn't have that luxury.
Right.
You know, people, myself included, were upset about that. So I told him, listen, I don't think it's right that you're hiding, sort of sniping at us from the bushes, but why not just start talking in class? And if I jump all over you and tell you you can't speak or I denounce you or something like that, then I guess you'll have an argument. But that's never happened, and I'm not going to do that. I tried to sort of coax him out of the bushes, and he wouldn't come. And so he was getting more and more threatening, and I started to worry about him. I really did.
And especially with the increased incidence of violence in schools.
That kind of stuff started to go through my head, and I didn't know what to do. I asked a few students what they thought. I tried to cajole him. I tried to coax him, and I finally said, listen, I want you just to get out of the class. I mean, if it's just so terribly dictatorial in there, you can't speak, et cetera, et cetera, maybe you should just get out. Was it a good time? Because we're about halfway through the term, just to get out gracefully and no harm done, that sort of thing. Then the investigation started, and he was the one person, I'm pretty sure, though I didn't ask for any names, I think he was the one student who volunteered to come forth and sort of testify against me, and he brought these emails out. And one of them was doctored. It's a query that he posed to some of the people, the students on the list, something about, hey, what's this sort of, you know, an innocuous thing about Mr. Harvey, what's he want us to do about some particular project or presentation or something? And it was, hey, you guys, like that. And then he had pasted, I mean, literally, like with a copy machine, a response from me to another, to something else, which was, I want you to get out of my class. So here's this query he poses to others, sort of just, you know, this question, what are we doing about such and such? And I supposedly responded with, you know, get out of my class, because right. you asked a question of the other students. The question wasn't even directed at me. So it was a really kind of ham-handed, you know, doctoring up of emails, and you could see where the margins didn't match up, and it wasn't in the right order, and you could tell the fonts were different. I mean, you know, it just looked all fake. My union president saw that right away, too. You know, and I pointed that out. But that was, I thought, just like one minor thing. I also point out the biggest falsification is that the accusation of one-sidedness, you know, that's a thing that, you know, I take seriously, that any person who's seeking the truth should take seriously if you only present one side of the issue. I think it's crazy considering the, you know, the barrage of jingoism that I'm only presenting one side of the issue. Again, just step outside the door. I was the only one providing any balance, I feel. But, you know, to respond to that whole thing of one-sidedness.
Well, I was going to also ask you about the allegation of the use of obscenity in class was something I'm a little curious about.
Oh, is it clear on here now?
Sure.
The quote in the report is that I said to some students, people in the military are stupid motherfuckers or something like that.
Yeah, that's what it says.
I mean, I'm so devious and poisonous, according to the reporter or to the investigator and to the Naples Daily News leading the charge against me, that I would, but at the same time I would be that stupid to say something like that in class. That never happens. There's no name attached to it or anything. And I never said that. And the other thing about the quote-unquote obscenity, quote-unquote profanity, is we were talking about censorship one day, and a student, somebody mentioned George Carlin's 10 Words You Can't Say on TV. Are you familiar with the...
Yeah, oh yeah.
So a student said, I have it, can I bring it in? So I said, sure, kid brought it. I mean, we're talking 17, 18-year-olds. Somewhere 16. And I prefaced the CD that he brought in by saying, listen, these words that some of you, you know, are taught that these are bad words, though George Carlin does a great job of explaining why they're not really and why other words like kill should be considered bad, much worse. And, I mean, it's not just comedy, it's philosophical. It's about censorship. Anyway, I gave him the opportunity to leave, and nobody left. People laughed a lot. I don't know. I think it comes down to... you know, and I knew the teaching of mass media class that this issue was going to come up.
Well, censorship, yes.
I mean, well, yeah, and when we study their contemporary music, I'm not going to tell them we're going to study Frank Sinatra. They're listening to rap music. They're listening to punk. They're listening to music in which people are using, and I keep saying quote-unquote because I'm with George Carlin on what's obscene and what's not obscene. You know, the word fuck to me is not obscene, but, you know, low-intensity warfare is. That's obscene. Not calling something what it is, that's obscene. Not covering, you know, the villages being decimated in Afghanistan, that's obscene. Those words like fuck, they're not obscene, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was all in the context of censorship and what's considered obscene and what isn't. And I knew when I took on the job of teaching mass media, I think 3-4 years ago, that when it came to their music as well, or film, mm-hmm. that this was going to be an issue. I mean, school, in a lot of ways, is such an artificial setup because they're not allowed to swear in school. Teachers aren't allowed to swear, and I don't swear frivolously. I don't swear just for, like he says, for shock value or humor or something like that. That's just a lie. Okay. It was that
well, it
one
makes
day.
It seem he makes it seem as if you're going around the classroom swearing gratuitously.
Right, exactly, and it was in that context on that day of censorship, and. I mean, I know that teachers do swear because students tell me that, but I pride myself in not letting things slip out in anger or in joking or any other kind of way. I pride myself on and trying to teach them the time and the place when you can do that and when people are going to take offense to that. I pride myself on that. It's just another one of the dialects that we need to master and know how to use and when to use, etc. But I mean, when music came up over the years, and I didn't get a chance to teach about lyrics to them because they took the classes away from you. We're going to do that coming up pretty soon after film, right after Christmas. But I mean, they're the whole object of that is I'm not a musician. I don't teach the about musical theory, but my area of expertise is the message, is about lyrics. So students bring in copies of lyrics to a particular song that they hold sacred, maybe an anthem. We do an assignment where you have to bring in your personal anthem. I mean, come on. Students are listening to music with these words that are called obscene in them. And so then they reproduce, they give 30 copies out to people in the room, and we discuss the lyrics. And we discuss about the use of quote-unquote obscenity and why it's in there, why do people use that. And we have great discussions about that sort of thing and about censorship. How any mass media teacher is going to teach music or teach about censorship without pointing it out in some kind of creative kind of way or just letting the words speak for themselves, the words that the students are listening to anyway, to me is just, it's a farce. I don't know how you get around that. I guess you just don't let them, you just tell them that they can't bring in lyrics that have any of these words, and I'm not going to censor that way.
It doesn't seem to be a sensible thing to do outside of a context about censorship.
Right, it's not. And I wouldn't do it that way. There's no reason for it. And it was in that context. Again, there's also the context of how do you talk about that kind of language in their music that they're listening to on a every second or not in class.
Well, yeah, the insinuation that the average, 10-year-old for that matter, doesn't hear four-letter words on an extremely frequent basis.
Right,
it's almost as ridiculous as the CNN thing.
As far as the media, the corporate media goes as well, and how it's changed over the years. Words that you would never hear on TV, now you do hear. Why has that changed? I mean, these are all, how these words has managed to creep in.
Right.
I mean, where does that come from? What I thought there was a women's movement. And, we talk about all these kinds of things in my classroom.
Yeah, well, we're definitely taking steps backwards.
Sure.
Regarding this report, one of our listeners actually was wondering with us earlier about, is Mr. Dubon, is that how you say his name?
It is.
What qualifications he had to interpret the Constitution.
Fifth Amendment,
like, is he
anything else that he does?
Is he a lawyer or something?
I don't know. I just know he has a card. And it's got the Collier County Public School System, shall we say, coat of arms, I don't know what you call it.
Yeah, probably.
From the royalty.
Logo.
On the top of it. And then it's got his name, and then it just says one word, a job description, investigator. So I wanted to quip things like, do you work full time? Do you work 40 hours a week investigating teachers?
Well, apparently he's
all
been working.
I know. Been working on a couple of my other colleagues for other things, not related to the bombing of Afghanistan, et cetera. But I know he stays pretty busy, I don't know if it's a full-time gig or what the qualifications are.
We should actually just also clear up what kind of discipline might likely be administered.
Oh, there was a cover letter attached to the report, but my understanding is that wasn't made public, right? This was written by the Director of Human Resources, Alan Hamlet. I don't think they made that public.
I read something in today's Naples Daily News that said that there was it mentioned a 3-day suspension.
The most that they're going to try to hand down to me is 3-day suspension without pay. Now, what I say to people is, you've got popular support, popular reactionary support from a vocal minority of people screaming from my head, screaming death threats at me in the street. They want me to be fired. You've got that behind you, and you're in charge of a school district, and you can fire people, okay, if you really want to. You've got that support. You've also got a mendacious report at your disposal, and still, the most you're going to try to get is 3 days.
Well, that just shows that it's meant to be a threat to you.
It's a chilling.
So that you come into line with whatever they think your curriculum should be.
Right, and the curriculum that he's always talking about, there's not much of one at all. It's very minimal. And all teachers do so much more than what the state curriculum says they're supposed to do. It just is bare bones. It basically says nothing. It's just vague, bland, says nothing.
Mm-hmm. So you're definitely following the curriculum.
Definitely. Yeah, I think he has a copy of that attached to his report, the state curriculum. And it talks about propaganda, that we have to introduce students to propaganda, and but I guess just not theirs.
Okay, well, thank you for taking all of this time out to talk with us
and thanks for
getting up early in the morning.
It's all right. Thank you.